A Matter of Spirit is the quarterly justice journal of the Intercommunity Peace and Justice Center. This article appeared in the fall 2018 issue on ethical decision-making. Rolling Away the Stone by Father John Whitney, S.J. Father John Whitney, S.J. is a Jesuit priest and pastor of St. Joseph Parish in Seattle. Previously, he has taught philosophy at Seattle University and worked as provincial superior of the Jesuits of the Northwest from 2002 to 2008. Jesus said, "Take away the stone." Martha, the dead man's sister, said to him, "Lord, by now there will be a stench. He has been dead for 4 days." Jesus said to her, "Did I not tell you that if you believe, you will see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone. From the Gospel of John, chapter 11, verses 39 to 41. Although there were hints of it earlier, as in the 1980s, when a major case was brought to light in Louisiana, for most Roman Catholics, the sexual abuse crisis in the church began in 2002, when the stories emerged in the Boston Globe showing both widespread abuse of children and vulnerable adults, and a church hierarchy who seemed determined to cover up and conceal years of allegations. Since those days, however, it has become apparent that the crisis of Boston is, in fact, a crisis for the whole church, proven by revelations throughout the United States, as well as Australia, Ireland, Chile, and most recently Germany. What at first seemed a scandalous breakdown of moral values and oversight authority has become something more, a challenge to the very survival of the institutional church. Especially since the recent Pennsylvania report, which traces 75 years of abuse and cover-up, a new attitude to the crisis seems to be forming among many in the church. For, even though heartbroken and disgusted by the stories of sexual exploitation and victimization of the most vulnerable among us, increasingly it is the nearly uniform response by those with authority in the church which has made many wonder if the problem might not be with the institution itself, i.e., might there be some fundamental flaw in the church exposed by this vicious and vast conspiracy of depravity and darkness? The search to find the flaw in the institutional church, which led to the cover-up of sexual abuse, has brought out many of the old causes in new forms. Among church traditionalists, the villain is the sexual revolution and the greater acceptance of homosexuality that has infiltrated the church and the thinking of many leaders. Ignoring both psychological research on sexual orientation and the evidence of the Pennsylvania report, where some of the most egregious acts occurred in the 1940s, the argument seeks to reinforce rather than reform the fundamental structure of hierarchy. At the same time, more progressive voices point to celibacy or the absence of women in clerical structures and leadership as the reason for the abuse of both children and power. And while there is strong evidence from other areas of society that the absence of women from any level of power in the church heightens the patriarchal structures of oppression and privilege, making the specialness of clerics not just a matter of association but a part of nature, there's no evidence that, if one maintains the same structures and merely brings women into them, that the abuse would be eliminated. Likewise, while celibacy creates a fundamental loyalty to the center of power, which has made the clerical caste more cohesive and self-protecting, there's no clear evidence that allowing marriage as such would mitigate sexual abuse, except, perhaps, by making the privacy of it harder to maintain. Celibates are not more likely to offend or cover up abuse just by virtue of their celibacy. What is common to all of these fixes is that they look for adjustment, i.e. tweaking, of the structures of the church, while ignoring that the structure itself may be based on a faulty premise, one which must be transformed if the church is to remain a viable institution into the future. Built on medieval ethical structures of caste and of a divine empowerment, the institutional church arose in a time of kings and princes. The Pope, ordained by God and chosen by the cardinals under divine inspiration, was heir of the emperor as well as vicar of Christ, and bishops were his princes. What checks or balances there were in this medieval structure came not through the voice of the people, but through the power of those also ordained and anointed in their offices, i.e., the feudal monarchs. Because of this ethic, the institutional church has often resisted movements such as the Enlightenment and the revolutions of the 18th and 19th centuries. Though Vatican II seems to break this model and speak of the church in the modern world, its documents and post-consular implementations reveal a fundamental and ongoing tension between this medieval ethos and the more egalitarian notions suggested by phrases such as the people of God and the priesthood of all believers. Though it sets the people of God as the primary definition of the church, the Council retains the notion that the structure of the church is ordained by God, and those called to ordained ministry are set aside from ordinary people when they are elevated to the diaconate, the presbyterate, or the episcopate. This concept of a clerical caste, concretized at the Council of Trent, with its teaching that ordination effects an ontological change in the subject, has historically wedded the institutional church to clericalism and made penetration of the veil of secrecy almost impossible. It is often noted that the church is not a democracy, as though the transcendent kingship of Christ necessitates a monarchical and feudal model of church governance on earth. Yet such is not the case, and the sexual abuse crisis shows how dangerous such thinking can be. Bound together by the ontological distinction of ordination, clerics are pushed to see as their peers only other priests, and to distinguish themselves from outsiders, a pressure reinforced by exclusive seminary training, by celibacy, by the exclusion of women from priesthood, and by an absence of required lay consultation. "We are different," clerics are told by word and implication, "and we care for each other and protect each other first." Though healthy men, raised in diverse communities, may resist this message, as many have, it is always part of the background of priesthood, and is heightened for those given responsibility, along with rings of power, to protect the institution and its members from, quote, others. Under such a system, it is small wonder that one's moral compass is undermined by the weight of an historical ethos. The reform of the church, then, must begin by breaking the power of the medieval ethic of caste. Taking seriously the work of Vatican II, the church must learn from the modern world the essential benefits and moral requirement of diversity in governance, and of educating all members to see other members as peers, not subjects nor rulers. It is no longer morally appropriate, if it ever was, to keep any part of the people of God from tables of power and decision-making. While maintaining an appropriate operational structure where decisions can be made and acted upon, the institutional church needs to move to escape its antiquarian tomb through the transformation or elimination of feudal systems of language, through the mandatory inclusion of women and other laity in the deliberations of bishops and in their selection, through a long process of education for priests that theirs is a call from within the community to the community, and through a separation of sacramental ministry and temporal power, and through a more expansive understanding of ordination. Though we may worry that moving the stone will mean unfastening the rock of Peter, if we believe, we may yet see the life that Christ will bring forth.